getaway trip? And I'm at the Hilton over here with my family, I say, pointing to my beautiful family a few feet away. My daughter saw the ad for your theme park and begged us to come. We told her that we would take her. We found a great deal on tickets on the website. Oh, yes, our web-only deal, very popular right now. Can I have your tickets? Yeah, you see, this is where I need your help so I don't get the Loser Dad of the Year award. My nervous laughter was covered by her smile. I explained, Tina, I saw the deal and my wife and I said, let's save the 15%, and we bought the tickets at the hotel computer. But after I got done paying, I couldn't print them because the hotel printer was down. But I was able to save it as a PDF and I emailed it to myself. I know this is an odd request, but would you log into my email account and print it out for me? Now, this account was a generic one filled with emails titled Pictures of the Kids, Dad and Mom's Anniversary, and things like that. I could tell that she was really struggling with this decision, and I was unsure whether the silence would be to my benefit. I said, I know it is a weird request, but my little girl is just dying to go, and I hate to tell her no. I point again to my daughter, who is doing a great job of being cute but impatient. Okay, how do I do it? Go to gmail.com. Log in with paul1234@gmail.com. And a password of BESMART. I know using this password is terrible in a way, but a little last-minute warning never hurt. It went unfollowed. Moments later, Tina was double-clicking on my PDF and getting a blank screen. Are you kidding me? Did I print it out wrong? Wow, I'm definitely getting the Loser Dad Award now. You know what, sir? I feel so bad for you. What if you just paid for the adult tickets, and I will let your daughter in for free today? Wow, that is so generous of you. With a smile, I forked over the $50 and thanked her for all her help and asked her to log out of my email. We part ways, with me having a happy daughter and the park having been compromised. Moments later, my partner text messaged me and told me that he was in and gathering data for the report. After enjoying a few hours of relaxation, we left the park to go back to work to compile the report for the Monday meeting. Applying the SE framework to the theme park hack. Information gathering, as shown in this case study, is not always majorly web-based. Instead, it can be done in person. The juiciest information in this case was gathered during an in-person visit, finding out what computer systems were used, feeling out the target to know how he or she would react to certain questions, and knowing how the ticketing system worked were major components of the information gathering stage. The real takeaway from this particular hack is that a good pretext is more than just a story. It's more than just some made-up costume and a phony accent. A good pretext is something you can easily live without too much effort. In this scenario, I was easily able to speak, act, and talk the father, because I am one. My concern about being a loser dad was real, not made up, and came across as real and then transferred to the target as genuine. This makes everything that is said more believable. Of course, having a cute kid in the distance looking longingly at the ticket lady helped, and so did a believable storyline about a hotel printer not working. Chapter 2 touched on this, but sometimes a social engineer will promote that pretexting or social engineering in general is just basically being a good liar. I do not believe that is the case. In a professional sense, pretexting involves creating a reality that will manipulate the target's emotions and actions to take a path you desire him to take. People are not often motivated by a simple lie. A social engineer must become the character in the pretext for a gig. Which is why using pretexts that are something you can closely follow, live, and act with ease is a good idea. The pretext of the free PDF software giveaway had a lot of room for error. The pretext was solid. But a quick rejection would have meant a couple-day lag in the next attack attempt. It was also a lucky guess that the same version of Adobe would be used company-wide, and that the particular teller I chose had not updated her particular version of Adobe Reader to the newest edition, which would have in essence nullified my exploit attempts. Banking on inherent human laziness is not a gamble I usually like to take, But in this case, it worked out. Sometimes the best bet is to move forward as if what you are asking for is already a done deal. That attitude promotes a feeling of confidence and comes across to the target that what you are saying or doing is legit. Using words and phrases such as, "I really need your help," is a powerful tool, as mentioned in Chapter 5. Humans inherently want to help each other, especially when asked. When asked, complete strangers will go to extraordinary lengths to help out, even, as is the case, opening an unknown file from someone else's email account. The plea to help a poor dad get his cute daughter into the park led to a compromised system. Once compromised, the software that stores all the credit card information for each guest was open wide to an attacker. The ability to collect that data with very little effort could have left the park open to massive loss, lawsuits, and embarrassment. Top secret case study number 1. Mission not impossible. Every now and then, my colleague and I are either involved in a situation or hear of a story that we would love to see turned into a movie, but for security reasons, we are not allowed to write or even speak of it. For those reasons, I cannot mention who was involved or what was taken in the story that comes to us from a social engineer named Tim. Tim's goal was to infiltrate a server that housed information that could be devastating if it fell in the wrong hands. The particular high-profile company involved had a lot to protect. When Tim was contracted to get this company's information, he knew he would have to pull out all the stops. This job would test the very limits of his social engineering skills. The target. The target is a high-profile organization with certain corporate secrets that should never be revealed to its competitors. The secrets had to be guarded on servers that did not have outside access and were only routable from the internal network. Tim was contracted to help the company test its security against a rogue person, being able to infiltrate and walk out with the goods. Tim met one person from the company at an off-site location to sign the deal they worked out over the phone and email. The story. Tim had a huge challenge in front of him. The first stage, as with any social engineering gig, was the information gathering. Not knowing what information he would and wouldn't use, Tim went full bore, collecting information such as the email layout scheme, open requests for quotes, all employee names he could find, plus any social media sites they belonged to, papers they wrote and published, clubs they were part of, as well as service providers they used. He went to do a dumpster dive, but when he scoped out the place, he noticed that security was very strong around the dumpster area. Many of the dumpsters were even enclosed in small walled areas, so he couldn't see the logos on the dumpster, unless he breached the perimeter. After finding out the department that handles waste services, he decided to place a well-planned-out phone call to the company. "Hello, this is Paul from TMZ Waste Disposal. We are a new waste disposal service in the area and have been working with some of the large corporations in the area. I am part of the sales team that handles your region. Could I send you a quote for our services?" "Well, we are pretty happy with our present supplier, but you can submit a quote." "Excellent. May I ask you just a few questions?"
"Sure."
"How many dumpsters do you have?" asked Tim. After asking whether they used special dumpsters for paper and technology such as USB keys and hard drives, he then laid out a few finishing touches. "What day is your normal pickup?"
"We have 2 pickups per week.
Set 1 is Wednesdays and set 2 is Thursdays."
"Thank you.
I can prepare this quote and have it sent over by tomorrow afternoon. What email should I use?"
"Send it to me personally, christy.smith@company.com.
At this point, a little friendly chit-chat ensued. Before you know it, they were laughing and exchanging pleasantries.
"Thanks a lot.
Hey, before we hang up, can I ask you who you presently use? I like to do a comparative quote."
"Well, you know," she hesitated, but then said, "Sure, we use Wasters Management."
"Thanks, Christy. I'll make sure you are happy with the quote. We'll talk later." Armed with this information, Tim went to the website for the present waste management company and copied the logo to a JPEG file.
He then visited an online shirt printer and in 72 hours had a shirt with the logo in his hands. Knowing that the garbage is picked up on Wednesday and Thursday, he wanted to go Tuesday night. He then placed another call to the security department. "Hello, this is John from Wasters Management, your dumpster disposal people. I was called by Christy Smith's office stating that you have a damaged dumpster. I know the pickup is on Wednesday, so I wanted to come out and check it tomorrow night. If there is a damaged unit, I will have the truck bring out a new one. Is it okay if I come out Tuesday night?" "Sure, just let me check." "Yes, Joe is on tomorrow. When you pull up, just stop in the security booth and he will give you a badge." "Thanks." The next day, Tim wore his company polo shirt and had a clipboard. The pretext was genius because he knew the dates and internal names. Now, looking like a company employee, he approached the security booth. "Joe, I'm John from Wasters. And I called in yesterday?" The guard interrupted with, "Yes, I see your name right here." He handed him a badge and a paper map telling him how to get to the dumpsters. "Do you need one of us to tag along?" "Nah, I do this all the time." Tim was buzzed in and drove over to the dumpsters. Armed with a perfect pretext and a badge, he had the time to do some digging. He knew that Set 2 holds the non-food garbage. So he started his digging there. After just a little while, he loaded a few hard drives, USB keys, some DVDs, and some clear bags full of paper in his trunk. After about an hour or so, he drove back out, thanked the security guys, and assured them all is good. Back at the office, he dug through the garbage and was greeted with some of the juiciest details he couldn't have found in his wildest dreams. Many times, companies will dispose of hard drives and USB media by destroying them completely. They will erase all data and then send them to special disposal units. Every now and then, though, employees who don't think through their disposal procedures will just throw away a USB key they say is broken or a hard drive that no longer boots. What they don't realize is that there are many programs that can strip data off even non-bootable drives and media. Even if the media has been formatted, data can still be recovered in many situations. One of the bags contained what looked like the contents of an office. As he emptied the bag, he noticed some papers that had not passed through the shredder. He sat down to read them and saw one was a contract for some IT services that went out for bid. The job was supposed to start in just a few days, but it looked like this particular copy was used to sop up some spilled coffee and then discarded. This would be a great find. But he had so much more to search through. The DVDs were blank or unreadable, but surprisingly enough, he located files on the USB keys. From this information, he discovered the names and private lines of the CFO as well as some other key personnel. The value of what he gathered was immense, but I want to focus on what he did next. The next morning, armed with the contract for the IT services in hand and knowing the type of work that was to be performed, he placed a call to the contract point of contact during the lunch hour and prayed the contact was out to lunch. "Hello, is Sebastian available?" "No, he's out to lunch. Can I help you?" "This is Paul from XYZ Tech. I wanted to confirm that our team will be coming in to start the project tomorrow evening." "Yes, just remember we can't have any interruption of service, so please do not get here any earlier than 5:30 p.m. "Yes, sir. You got it. See you tomorrow." The next day, Tim knew that he couldn't arrive with the rest of the team, but if he timed it right, he would not be caught by the IT company or the target. Sitting across the dark parking lot, he watched the IT contract company arrive. After a good 30 minutes, he approached the front door and explained how he just ran out to get some paperwork from his car. He got buzzed in and now had free rein of the office. He needed to do some reconnaissance, and he figured the best way was to approach the IT company as one of the internal employees. He walked around until he heard someone talking and found one of the guys in a shirt identifying him as one of the IT team. Armed with the names of the upper-level management from the USB key files and from the point of contacts From the contract, he began, "Hi there, I'm Paul. I work with Mr. Shavaz, the CFO. Did someone explain to you about the Prod 23 production server?" Tim had the server name from his information gathering. Tim knew that was the server he was attacking. "Yes, we know that server is off limits in this work. The CFO explained to us the encryption and how we are not to mess with that server. No worries." After a few more minutes of conversing, Tim had discovered some valuable pieces of information. "The IT team is not to touch the server. The server has full disk encryption. The techs were bragged to by the in-house IT guy about how the target company uses a key file on a USB key that only admins carry." Tim knew this last point would make his task harder, and because the admins were not in, he would not be able to access the server now. In addition, the physical security around the server was very intense and may have been too hardened to take the risk. He did know that the admins would have access to the server, so he thought maybe he would try that avenue. He visited the first office of the admin, but it was locked. He checked the second office, then the third. The third one was shut, but had not been closed all the way, and it merely opened when he pushed a little. He was in. By shutting the blinds and leaving the lights off, he felt he would be protected a bit from the potential of being caught. In his social engineer kit, he carried a wide variety of tools and clothing. One of the tools he always had with him on these types of gigs was a USB key that he loaded with a bootable Linux distribution, such as Backtrack. In the Backtrack install is a preloaded version of VirtualBox, a free open-source virtual machine tool. He loaded the admin's computer using the rear USB port into Backtrack. After he was in Backtrack, he connected his own servers via SSH to set up a listener, then connected back to it using a reverse shell he initiated from the admin's machine. Then he started a key sniffer to log all the keystrokes typed on the computer in Backtrack and set up the log file to be dumped through the SSH connection to his computer. Then he did something truly pernicious. He opened VirtualBox and created a Windows Virtual Machine, VM, using the local hard drive as the physical media to boot from, and loaded the VM. Automatically, it loaded the admin's user profile and OS. At the login screen, he loaded the VM to be in full screen mode, hid all bars, and made the existing hotkey to exit VirtualBox some ridiculously long combo. This protects the user from mistakenly hitting that combo and revealing they are hacked. A risk still existed that he could be caught at any moment using this method of rear USB key loading a virtual machine using their own hard drive, but if it worked, he would get every keystroke the admin typed and a shell on the poor guy's computer, giving Tim access to everything. Even though the shell would be on the virtual machine, he would be logging all his keystrokes and then gain access to the victim's machine using his captured username and password. Tim did a few other things in the office, such as set up a connection on another machine, which gave him network access remotely. He also set up a remote listening device, the kind that uses a cell phone SIM card. He could call its number from any phone on Earth and listen to conversations from anywhere in the 20-foot radius. After just a few hours, Tim left the target's company and went back to his office. He was excited to see whether all this worked, but he still had a few more ideas to try. Early the next morning, he made sure his remote connections were still alive, and he dialed into his listener to hear the early morning buzz of people coming into the office. The anticipation built as he waited to see whether first computer logs were coming through, capturing the admin's username and password. About an hour later, Tim saw some logs coming through. He knew that he didn't want to do anything that would compromise his connection, so he waited. Around 12:15, the logs stopped, so he figured the admin must be at lunch. He quickly checked his reverse shell and began to create a tunnel from the admin's machine to the server back to his machine using the password he captured and the admin for the server. After the tunnel was connected, he made a mad dash to copy as much as he could before 1 p.m. At that time, he didn't notice any logs, so he called into the listener and overheard someone asking, "Do you know how long this meeting is supposed to last?" Figuring the admin might be at a meeting, he made another attempt at a larger transfer. After about 30 minutes, he noticed some activity, so he stopped data collection and decided to wait until later. He didn't want to alert the admin to anything fishy going on by slowing down his connection through a large transfer. He started to sift through what he grabbed from the server, knowing he hit the jackpot. His job wasn't over yet. That evening, he did one more massive transfer, taking as much as he could, and then headed over to the company's office again, social engineering his way in as he did before. Once in, he headed over to the admin's office, which was locked this time and pulled shut. He used a shove knife to get in. Once inside, he turned off the virtual machine, then rebooted the machine after removing the USB key. And then, he left the admin's office the way he found it. He collected his listener and made sure his tracks were covered. He exited the building to go back to his office and compile his findings. Of course, at the report meeting, he walked in with a stack of printed documents and a hard drive full of what he was able to copy. This was enough to drop the jaws of every person in the room. Applying the SE framework to Top Secret 1. This story offers many lessons. It is an example of a perfect social engineer. It can be summed up as practice, preparation, and of course, information gathering. All the skills he used, we can imagine he practiced. From using a shove knife and creating tunnels, to effective pretexting and information gathering. I cannot reiterate enough the importance of information gathering. I know I have said it 1,000 times, but this whole deal would have fallen through without Tim having the appropriate information. Being prepared through phone calls and on-site visits and having the right hardware led to success. Analyzing this hack, you can see some of the fundamental principles of social engineering at play. Tim was a master at information gathering, using web resources to pull up all sorts of nuggets, expert elicitation skills while on the phone, as well as masterful persuasion skills in person. These techniques allowed him to gather data that probably would have been left behind by an unskilled hacker. Information gathering gave Tim the foundation for what types of pretexts and questions to develop. The dumpster dive was planned with surgical precision. Does a chance exist that he would have been let in without the shirt and appointment? Sure. Yet how much more powerful was it the way he did it? He never left a doubt in their minds, and he enabled each person he interacted with to go about their business and never think twice. This is a perfect pretext when a person can interact with you without any red flags or warning signs going up. Tim did that, and it gave him freedom to move around as if he belonged. The best part of the story is what happened after he got in the building. Such a large margin for error existed, and he could have been caught in so many ways. Sure, he could have run in, grabbed the data off the server and left, and probably no one would have stopped him, but doing it the way he did meant the company never knew how their secrets got out, and would never have known they were compromised. Tim took a huge risk when he left the admin's computer running a VM. That particular maneuver could have failed in many ways. If someone had ever rebooted the computer, or it had crashed, or if by mistake the admin pressed that crazy key combo, it could have spelled the end to the hack and alerted the company that it had been compromised. I might have taken a different, less risky route, one where I could have created a reverse tunnel from his computer back to my servers using a custom EXE that would not be detected by antivirus software, and in the startup scripts of the computer, something with less chance of failure. But Tim's method had the flair of being a very sexy social engineering hack. Probably more than one lesson can be learned from this particular hack. But if anything, the old hacker adage, trust no one, can be applied to some extent. If someone calls to say that Christine authorized a dumpster inspection and you didn't hear it from her or a memo, call her and ask. Turn your computers off at night and definitely make sure your important machines are not able to boot from USB without a password. Sure, these extra precautions will mean more work and longer load times. Whether they're worth doing depends on how important the data that sits behind those machines is. In this case, the data was able to ruin this company, so the protection should have been extreme. Although the company took many excellent precautions, like using full disk encryption, cameras, biometric locks, and so on around the server area, it did not secure the computers that had access to the most important data. And that is what led to the company's demise. Top secret case study number 2. Social engineering a hacker. Thinking outside the box and having to think fast is standard fare for a social engineer. So it is rare to be in a situation that will challenge the professional social engineer to the point of being stumped. What happens when a penetration tester is called on to put on a social engineering hat without prior warning? This next account shows exactly what happens when this situation arises. It is a good example of how having certain social engineering skills practiced beforehand can be very useful when called on to use them without warning. The target. John was called on for a standard network penetration test for one of his bigger clients. It was a no-thrills pen test, as social engineering and on-site work were not included in the audit outline. Still, he enjoyed the work of testing out the vulnerabilities of his clients' networks. In this particular pen test, nothing really exciting was occurring. He was doing his normal routines of scans and logging data and testing out certain ports and services he felt might give him a lead inside. Near the end of a day, he ran a scan using Metasploit that revealed an open VNC server, a server that allows the control of other machines in the network. This is a nice find, because overall, the network was locked down, so this sort of easy in is especially welcome. John was documenting this find with the VNC session open, when suddenly, in the background, the mouse started moving across the screen. This was a huge red flag, because with this client at this time of the day, no user would be connected and using the system for a legitimate purpose. What could be happening? He noticed that instead of acting like an admin or normal user, this person appeared to be not very knowledgeable about the system. He suspected there was an unwanted intruder in the network. He didn't want to scare the intruder away, but wanted to know whether he was an admin or another hacker who found his way into the very same system. Quickly, the target went from being the company he was hired to pen test to a rogue hacker inside the organization. The story. John decided quickly that he would have to social engineer this hacker and get as much information as possible to help safeguard his client. He didn't really have time to think through every step and plan out properly. He didn't have time to do the appropriate information gathering. He takes a big risk and opens Notepad. Quickly, he develops the pretext that he is a noob hacker. A newbie, someone unskilled, and he found this box open and is hacking it, like this guy. John starts the conversation and every other line is the hacker. It is long, but the transcript shows exactly what transpired in this hack. John speaks first. John. What's up? Hacker. Just looking around. John. Yeah, me too. Anything good? Hacker. You're a hacker too? You was just looking for unsecured VNC servers? John. Smiley emoticon. Hacker. I was looking for something easy. This was easy. You see anything else on this network? This is the only one I got. John. Didn't find anything else of interest here. Most is secured, pretty good. Yeah, easy to gain access, but I want admin privileges. Hacker. Yeah, would be easy from here. Just priv elev. I am interested in what else is here. What is this spreadsheet that is always up?
John, I have no idea. It was here when I logged in. I haven't been around much. Found this computer 2 hours ago, maybe. What about you?
Hacker,
I had it for about a week, off and on. Just did not do anything with it. Sort of lazy.
What was your test file from RapidShare?
I just dump strings on it and don't recognize anything.
John,
cool. Well, the file was just a test I made. Was trying to see if I could get a server, Trojan, running. But the firewall didn't allow it.
Hacker, LOL, I had the same problem. I did Metasplit shell, and no go. That's why I kept using this.
You in the US, or out of country?
I know some people in Denmark.
John, I'm from Norway, actually.
Hehe, I have relatives in Denmark.
Hacker, you hanging any boards?
Like, I used to like some, but they have been going away.
John, I mostly hang in some programming boards, but not much else.
Have you been into hacking for a long time or what?
What's your age, by the way? I'm 22.
Hacker,
I have been on this for like fun for around a year or so. Still in school, 16, just something to do.
You ever go to Evil Zone?
John, haven't been there.
I too mostly do this for fun. Just trying to see what I can do, test my skills. I wrote the VNC Finder myself, by the way. I have found a lot of servers. But this is the only one where I could actually have some fun.
Hacker, wow, what did you write it in?
Can I download it?
Do you have a handle?
John, it's written in a language called Pure Basic. But it's kinda not ready for release yet. It's only for my own use. But maybe I can share it anyway. I could upload the code somewhere and let you compile it. That is, if you can find some Pure Basic compiler on some where site.
Hacker,
that's cool. You can put it in the Pastebin site from IRC. That lets you a non-post. I have done Pure Basic before, just Python and Perl.
John,
let me see. I'll look for that Pastebin site and upload it. Just give me some minutes. I'll be around.
Hacker,
okay, cool.
Do you have a handle?
I go by Jack_Ruby.
John, handle? For what?
I don't chat on IRC much or anything like that, but I could give you an email you could reach me on.
Hacker, that's cool. I mean handle like for IRC and boards and the such.
Hey, email works too.
John,
yeah, at the programming board I share my full name, etc. Maybe not too smart to share just yet. My email is intruder@hotmail.com.
Hacker,
send me a message or whatever, and I can add you on MSN maybe.
John, I will send you a note.
It is good to have someone that can program to know for this sort of stuff, for when I get stuck or find something good.
Hacker,
hehe, yeah, we could be a team.
John, cool. Let me know, did you get the paste bin?
John,
by the way, it is kind of very in the alpha stage. The GUI is not really finished, but it can be configured through some variables.
Hacker, cool, I will test it and see what I can do with it. Thanks for sharing. If I do something cool, should I email you?
John, yeah, please do. If you run this program for some hours, you'll find lots of servers. I've even tried to make some code to detect servers that has no security, and even some that has bug, which can let you log in even if it has a password. These servers will show up in the result, the found tab, as insecure. But sometimes it does a mistake and says some are insecure, which are not. But that's not many. It's just to test them.
Hacker, wow, I saw some other VNC servers here too, but they all want passwords. Does your tool let us into that?
John,
just a very few has the bug which can let you in. But you must use the special client for them. More info here, by the way.
Pasted a link.
Hacker, downloaded the zip file.
John,
LOL, K.
Hacker,
sorry, okay, I will download that and have a look. That's cool. Did you write the backdoor from RapidShare too, or did you get that from someplace?
John, I try to write most of my tools myself. This way I learn. So yes, I wrote it myself, but it was not finished.
I just want to see if I can run a server. But it didn't do anything yet, Hacker. I see. I sort of gave up. But I thought I would come back and try some more. I figure there has to be some stuff around. But I don't have a botnet of my own to use. This guy named Zoot54 tried to sell me one, and some people vouched for him, but I did not trust him at all. And I don't know how to write my own tools and all other than some Perl and Python, which won't work for most window hosts like this. So I have been trying the Megasploit, but getting a firewall error. Do you have plans for this? Like something cool to do? Or just move on to the next? John. Perl and Python is a good start, by the way. I haven't been using them myself, but when you know some languages, you can easily learn more. Maybe you should give Pure Basic a try. It's really easy, actually. A botnet would be cool. I was thinking about making one, but it's kind of hard to make it spread, at least on Vista. But, nah, I can't give up this server just yet. I have to try some more. There has to be a way to get more privileges. Hacker. That's cool. You can have the server, as I have had it for a while and don't know what to do next. Let me know what you're doing if you would, so I can learn some more, though. That would be cool. Do you have a MySpace or Facebook or anything, or just the email? John. Email works for now. When I trust you more, maybe I can add you to Facebook. I don't have a MySpace. Yeah, I'll keep you updated. Hacker. Cool, that works for me. Do you have a shell, or do you have this same GUI? Is it just a multi-connection VNC? John. Yeah, I used the Thight VNC, or whatever, and made it disconnect other users. I'm not a shell fan, really, Hacker. Cool, when I get a shell, a lot of times I make mistakes and disconnect on accident. John. Good you didn't disconnect me. By the way, when I first saw you messing around, I was like, damn, the administrator is here, Hacker. Ha, no, I looked up the time zone, and they are in the middle of the U.S., so it is the middle of the night for them. John. Yeah, I did the same thing. Even did a speed test of the internet connection, They seem to have faster upload speed than download speed. Weird, but handy for a DoD attack, maybe. DOS, I mean. Hacker. Weird, I wonder what type of line it is that says it is coming from CO. Which I thought was a funny name. Did you ever get any other systems here? I once saw a Wares server, but that was a long time ago and it is gone now. John. Haven't found any other systems, but I would sure like to access all these network computers they have. Damn many. It's some kind of university. I printed out Hello World previous day. Ha, did you send it to a printer or to the screen? These people would more than likely freak out if they saw the mouse start moving on them in the middle of the day with a weird spreadsheet. John. Haha, they probably would. But what silly idiots runs a VNC viewer without a password? I printed to some of the printers. I hope somebody saw it. Hacker. Ha, that's true. I bet some. Well, they can't run it without admin's privs, right? So it can't be just some user that did it. Someone with admin would have to do it, or else our back doors should work on it. And they are not going at all. Or do you think someone just changed the config? John, well, I think you're right. Some admin or prankster. Hacker, do you do this work for a living? I keep hearing you can make money with it. And I think if I do this for a while and get to be good, I might be able to get a job with it. Is that what you did? John. I have earned money on programming, but never on hacking or security stuff. But that's a good idea. People would pay to get their security tested. And if we get good enough, we could probably earn a lot this way. Hacker. That's what I hope. I bought a book on the ethical hacker, and I think that they have some good programs in there. I don't know what the age is to take the test. But if I do take it, that might be a good start to do this work. Are there some good tools in there, like the Metasploit? You should take a look at it if you had not yet. John. Yeah, thanks. I should check that out. But I'm getting a little tired now, by the way. Can't sit here chatting in bloody notepad all day. So, see you later, man. Cool meeting you. Very fun. Hacker. Yeah, I was scared when I saw RapidShare up on the screen. Cool to meet you, and I will email you, let you know how the program works. That is exciting to try that out and see what happens. You stay safe, and don't let the bad guys find you. John. Hee hee, thanks. Same for you, by the way. This was interesting. I think I'll save this notepad log, by the way. Give me a sec, lol. There, lol, sorry. Goodbye. Bye.
This chat reveals how quickly John had to pretext and become someone else. This is not an easy task, as usually it takes a lot of planning, but to secure his client and find out who this intruder was, he had to play whatever role the hacker was going to put him in. In the end, John ended up getting his picture, email, and contact info. He reported this malicious hacker to his client, and the problem was fixed not to allow such free rein in and out of its systems. This top secret case shows just how social engineering used in a professional sense can go a long way toward securing clients. Applying the SE framework to the top security case study 2. What I find interesting in this account is how the company wasn't really a target for the hacker. He was merely scanning the internet for low-hanging fruit, and that is exactly what he found. Open machines with full access are dangerous, and this account shows just how much damage could have occurred if the pen tester was not sitting there just at the right time. There is, of course, a lot one can learn about social engineering from this story, too. John did not come into this project with the idea of using his social engineering skills. Instead, it was a straight-out pen test. Sometimes you are called on to use your skills without being able to plan first. What might have enabled John to be able to do this without having to go home and have a practice session? Most likely these skills were something that John used daily, or that he at least practiced often enough to make him agile in his use of them. The main lesson in this case study is probably practice makes perfect. Realistically, John could have confronted the hacker, told him he was an admin, and that he was being logged, and that his life was over. All sorts of threats could have flown back and forth, and he could have tried to use fear as his main tactic. Most likely, the hacker would have fled the scene, only to return later to try to format the system or do even more damage to cover his tracks. Instead, thinking very fast, John was able to farm a lot of useful information on his target. John later used the target's email address and name and a good copy of Malt Ego to get a very clear picture of this individual's activities. Another minor lesson one can learn from analyzing this story is how to be fluid. What I mean by that is learning to go with the flow. When John started gathering information from the hacker, he really didn't know whether this person was a hacker or an admin. John's first line, "Hey, what's up?" could have been answered by the attacker in many ways. Without knowing exactly the response he would get, John had no time to really prepare. He had to try to use lingo and react the way he imagined a hacker would. John took it even a step farther, realizing that the best avenue was a submissive one. John put the pretext of a noob or new hacker who didn't know much and wanted a wonderful and intelligent real hacker to educate him. John got him to spill his guts about all sorts of things, including all his contact information and even a picture. Why case studies are important. These case studies are just a few of the stories that are out there, and these are by far not the scariest. Everyday governments, nuclear power plants, multi-billion dollar corporations, utility grids, and even whole countries fall victim to malicious social engineering attacks. And that doesn't even include the personal stories of scams, identity thefts, and robbery that are occurring by the minute. As sad as all these stories are, one of the best ways to learn is by reviewing case studies. Experts from all fields utilize this methodology. Psychologists and doctors review countless hours of tapes and interviews to study microexpressions people use when feeling certain emotions. Persuasion experts review, analyze, and study accounts of positive and negative persuasion. Doing so helps them to pick up on the subtle areas that affect people,
and see how they can be used to learn to protect their clients. Law enforcement reviews case studies as part of their everyday lives to learn what makes criminals tick. Along those lines, criminal investigators analyze and dissect every aspect of a malicious person, including what he eats, how he interacts with others, what he thinks about, and what makes him react. All of this information helps them to truly understand the mind of the criminal. These same methods are how professional profilers target and catch the bad guys. In the same fashion, professional social engineers learn a lot by studying not only their own case studies, but also case studies in their own practice and malicious accounts they can find in the news. By reviewing case studies, a social engineer can truly start to see the weakness of the human psyche and why the tactics in this social engineering framework work so easily. That is why I have been working hard to make sure the framework on social-engineer.org will include updated web stories and case studies that you can use to enhance your skills. In the end, all of these exploits worked because people are designed to be trusting, to have levels of compassion, empathy, and a desire to help others. These are qualities that we should not lose as we have to interact with our fellow humans every day. Yet at the same time, these qualities are the very things that are more often than not exploited by malicious social engineers. It may seem that I am promoting each of us to become a hardened, emotionless creature that walks around like a robot. Although that would definitely keep you protected from most social engineering attempts, it would make life dull. What I am promoting is being aware, educated, and prepared. Summary. Security through education is the mantra of this book. Only when you are aware of the dangers that exist, only when you know how the criminal thinks, and only when you are ready to look that evil in the eye and embrace it, can you truly protect yourself. To that end, the final chapter of the book discusses how to prevent and mitigate social engineering attacks. Chapter 9. Prevention and Mitigation. The preceding chapters show you all the methods and ways that social engineers trick and scam targets into divulging valuable information. They also describe many of the psychological principles that social engineers use to influence and manipulate people. Sometimes, after I give a speech or security training, people will look very paranoid and scared and say something like, "It just seems there is no hope to even attempt security. How do I do it?" That is a good question. I promote having a good disaster recovery plan and incident response plan, because nowadays it seems that it is not a matter of if you will get hacked, but when. You can take precautions to give you at least a fighting chance at security. Social engineering mitigation is not as easy as ensuring hardware security. With traditional defensive security, you can throw money into intrusion detection systems, firewalls, antivirus programs, and other solutions to maintain perimeter security. With social engineering, no software systems exist that you can attach to your employees or yourself to remain secure. In this chapter, I present the top 6 steps I tell my clients they can take to prevent and mitigate social engineering attempts. Learn to identify social engineering attacks. Creating a personal security awareness program. Creating awareness of the value of the information that is being sought by social engineers. Keeping software updated. Developing scripts. Learning from social engineering audits. These 6 points all boil down to creating a security awareness culture. Security awareness is not about a 40, 60, or 90-minute program once every year. It is about creating a culture or a set of standards that each person is committed to utilizing in his or her entire life. It is not just about work or websites deemed to be important, but it is the way one approaches being secure as a whole. This chapter covers the aforementioned 6 points and how creating a security awareness culture can be the best defense against a malicious social engineer. Learning to identify social engineering attacks. The first stage in social engineering prevention and mitigation is to learn about the attacks. You don't have to dive so deep into these attacks that you know how to recreate malicious PDFs or create the perfect con. But understanding what happens when you click a malicious PDF and what signs to look for to determine whether someone is trying to trick you can help protect you. You need to understand the threats and how they apply to you. Here's an illustration. You value your home and the things in it, but especially the people in your home. You do not wait to have your first fire to figure out how to plan, prevent, and mitigate its danger. Instead, you install smoke detectors and plan an escape route in case of a fire. In addition, you might train your children with the phrase to stop, drop, and roll if they are on fire. You teach them how to feel the door for heat and stay low to avoid smoke inhalation. All of these methods are ways to prevent or prepare for a fire before you have a real fire and have to deal with the devastation it brings. The same principles apply to protecting yourself and your company from social engineering attacks. Do not wait for the attack to occur to learn about how devastating they can be. Don't think I'm self-serving, but I promote social engineering audits to regularly test your employees' ability to withstand these attacks, and following up with training. Teach yourself and your employees how to stop, drop, and roll, so to speak, when it comes to these types of attacks. What are the latest news stories on how social engineers are attacking companies? Knowing them can be the first line of defense, the same as knowing what a fire can do to your home. Learn the different methods that modern social engineers and identity thieves use. You can find an archive of news stories and examples of social engineers, con men, identity thieves, and the like at social-engineer.org. Another good step is this book. It is full of all the methods and principles that social engineers use to manipulate their targets. This book is more than just a compilation of stories and wonderful hacks. It offers an analysis of the thinking and tactics used by the malicious social engineer. Also, check out the videos on the social-engineer.org site, which demonstrate exploits in action. The average user does not need to watch them with the intent of understanding how to perform these attacks himself, but to understand how an SE performs the attack. Basically, the more you know about how these attacks occur, the easier you can identify them in the wild. Being aware of the body language, expressions, and phrases used in an SE attempt will make your ears perk up when you hear or see someone utilize these methods. You don't need to spend tons of time learning about SE methods. However, spending a few minutes now and then reading the news and reading stories on social-engineer.org or other sites can help you see the methods being used now against companies. After you have a good basis of knowledge and an audit under your belt, the next step, creating a security-minded culture, will seem simple to develop. Creating a personal security awareness culture. In July of 2010, I was part of a small team of security professionals that held one of the first organized and professional-level social engineering contests at DEF CON 18. Some of the best and brightest minds from around the globe come to Las Vegas, Nevada once a year to speak, teach, and learn. My team and I decided it would be a great opportunity to hold a contest that would showcase whether corporate America is vulnerable to this attack vector. Responding to a contest. We organized the contest by having interested people sign up to take part in two stages of social engineering: information gathering and active attacks. To keep the contest legal and moral, we did not want any person victimized, and no social security numbers, credit card numbers, and no personal identifying information would be gathered. Our goal was not to get any of these people fired. In addition, our goal was not to embarrass any particular company, so we decided also no passwords or other personal security-related information from these companies. Instead, we developed a list of about 25 to 30 flags that ranged from whether the company had an internal cafeteria, to who handles its trash disposal, to what browser it uses, and to what software it uses to open PDFs. Finally, we chose target companies from all sectors of business in corporate America. Gas companies, tech companies, manufacturers, retail, and everything in between. Each contestant was assigned one target company in secret, on which he had 2 weeks to do passive information gathering. That meant contestants were not allowed to contact the company, send it emails, or in any way try to social engineer information out of it. Instead, they had to use the web, Multego, and other tools to gather as much information as possible and enter all they found into a professional-looking report. From the information gathered, we wanted contestants to develop a couple of plausible attack vectors that they thought would work in the real world. Then, contestants had to come to DEF CON in Las Vegas, sit in a soundproof booth, and make a 25-minute phone call to their target to implement their attack vector and see what information they could obtain. I could spend the next 20 to 30 pages telling you what happened at that contest and what the outcome was, but one thing we found was this. Every contestant obtained enough information out of the targets that the company would have failed a security audit. Regardless of the experience level of the contestant and the pretext, the contestants were successful in accomplishing their goals. Now on to what applies here. Security awareness. Corporations that care about security have programs where they train their employees how to be aware of potential security risks via phone, internet, or in person. What we have found was that security awareness in those companies was at failure stage. Why? How could it be that these Fortune 500 companies that spend millions or more on security, training, education, and services designed to protect their employees could be failing at security awareness? That is my point in the title of this section. Security awareness is not personal to employees. Often in my professional practice, when I talk to employees about their feelings about an attack, they respond with something like, "It's not my data, what do I care?" This attitude shows that the security awareness that these companies were trying to instill never hit home. It was not important, effective, and most importantly, not personal. In reviewing much of the material and methods available for so-called security awareness, what I have found is that it is boring, silly, and not geared to make the participant interact or think. Short DVD presentations that cover a ton of things and a shotgun approach that blasts a participant with a lot of tiny little facts are not designed to sink in too deep. What I challenge you to do as a company or even as an individual is to create a program that engages, interacts, and drives deep into security awareness. Instead of just telling your employees why having long and complex passwords is a good idea, show them how quickly one can crack an easy password. When I am asked to help perform security awareness training for a client, sometimes I ask an employee to come up to my computer and type in a password that she feels is secure. I do this before I release any information about passwords. Then, as I start my presentation on that section, I start a cracker against that password. Usually within a minute or two, the password is cracked, and I reveal to the room the password that was secretly typed into my computer. The immediate and drastic effect it has on each person has an extreme impact. But after numerous demonstrations like that, employees will comment on how they now understand how serious having a good password is. When I discuss the topic of malicious attachments in email, I do not have to show employees how to craft a malicious PDF. But I do show them what it looks like from both the victim's and the attacker's computers when a malicious PDF is opened. This helps them understand that a simple crash can lead to devastation. Of course, this teaching method produces a lot of fear, and although that is not the goal, it is not a terrible side product, because employees will remember it better. But the goal is to make them think, not just about what they do not only at work and with their office computers, but also their own bank accounts, home computers, and how they treat security on a personal level. I want each person who hears a security presentation or listens to this book to review how they interact with the internet as a whole and make serious changes to reusing passwords, storing passwords or personal information in non-secure locations, and to where they connect to the internet. I cannot tell you how many times